Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Tuesday, January the 11th, 2022, education section. Student says perseverance is a family trait. Midland College student Zader Kadir grew up very attached to school. After her parents divorced when she was only 2 months, she was a pawn in custody battles, but school was always a constant in her life. "I got to see the opposite of a stable home life," Kadir admitted. "When I was in elementary school, my brother and I went back and forth between our parents. It was very stressful because my father's home was unstable. I felt like I was living two completely different lives. At my father's, we experienced emotional abuse and witnessed physical abuse between my then stepmother and him. My mother's home, on the other hand, was very stable. We ate dinner together as a family, and my mother and stepfather helped me with homework. My father's home consisted of a tiny, single-wide trailer that was completely trashed with more than 5 dogs, and we would not get enough to eat. Though she sometimes went hungry, Kadir's family gave her the most precious gift by showing her the value of hard work. Her grandmother, on her father's side, was born in Guyana. She had 5 children, and her husband died when they were young. She decided to immigrate to the U.S. and worked as a nurse. She was eventually able to send enough money back so all her children could also come to the U.S. Kadir's grandmother, on her mother's side, was born into hard labor. When she was in 8th grade, she had to be pulled out of school to help with cotton picking. Her family later got into the lumber business, where she learned how to haul massive trucks of lumber at a very young age. She met Kadir's grandfather at a box factory where they dropped off lumber to be processed. "Both my grandmothers grew up in poverty," she said. It wasn't an even middle class, just plain and simple poverty. They worked every day to provide for what was on the table every night. When my mother and father got divorced, she was caught in the same cycle. She had nothing. She looked at my brother, then 3, and me, 2, and thought, how am I ever going to give my kids a future? What am I going to pass down to them? Kadir's mother decided to go back to college at MC. As a full-time mother and full-time student, she also worked 2 jobs. She persevered, transferred to Texas Tech, graduated with a degree in chemistry, and became a teacher. "My mother did what no one in my family could do for generations. She rose out of poverty. She did what no one expected her to do as a single mom or as a woman. She went into a science field that, at the time, did not embrace females. She constantly overcame the odds. My mother worked as hard as possible to get her classes, get good grades, and take care of my brother and me. She was able to work hard in every aspect of her life. I admire her." Kadir made it her mission to follow her mother's example, to pick a goal and work toward it. But after high school, she didn't know what the goal would be and didn't feel comfortable attending college if she did not know what she wanted to do. She also could not financially afford it. So Kadir worked a couple of jobs post high school. It was not until she started substitute teaching that she discovered her passion. "I completely fell in love with teaching," she said. "I started daydreaming. What if I could do this every single day? What if I had my own students?" Kadir is confident she can be the teacher who sees when her students are struggling because she went through it firsthand. "I was inspired to go back to school to become a teacher. I am finally finding my direction, and it is all because of the legacy of hard work that has passed down to me. I am here because I am standing on the shoulders of my family. They taught me to put everything into what I do. They taught me that every opportunity is a completely open door you should walk through, and I have run through those doors at MC. As a young woman and a young woman of color, when doors open, you take it. Conversely, my family taught me if a door is not open, kick it down. Fight for what you want and completely go for it. Schools like Midland College can help. Kadir's story is part of Legacy Stories, a collaboration between the Midland College Equity Committee and the Alpha Beta Phi chapter of Phi Theta Kappa Honor Society. To help Kadir tell her story and hear other stories, visit midland.edu/equity. Through Legacy Stories, MC students are exploring how inherited expressions of truth build lasting legacies. Students believe it is only through the telling of stories and meaningful dialogue that we can challenge stereotyping and undo prejudices. MISD hosts school fair at MLK Center. The Midland ISD school fair took place Saturday at the MLK Center. It was an opportunity for the public to visit with representatives from MISD's 40 campuses in one place and learn how to apply to schools and programs that best fit a child's interests and aptitudes. It also allowed families to learn more about the options and opportunities available at pre-K, elementary, junior high, and high school. Families and students will have the chance to visit the campus of their choice this week when the district conducts campus tours. PBAF opens awards sign-up. Permian Basin Area Foundation is pleased to announce the opening of the 2022-23 school scholarship cycle. Students and counselors may view eligibility and selection criteria for more than 85 scholarships through the application platform. Academic works, which can be accessed through the Permian Basin Area Foundation website, www.pbaf.org. The application deadline is March 31st. The foundation is looking forward to connecting Permian Basin students with local scholarship opportunities here at the foundation, said Sherry Helting, scholarships administrator. Applicants are required to complete only one online application, which will then place them in a pool of scholarships for which they may qualify. However, it will be very important to read all instructions because approximately one dozen scholarships are unique in their criteria with an outside application, a second essay, or a different deadline. Permian Basin Area Foundation awarded more than $1 million in scholarships to area students during the last academic year. These awards are made possible by numerous donors to the foundation's scholarship funds in support of local students pursuing higher education. To learn more about scholarships, grants, and the philanthropic work of donors partnering with Permian Basin Area Foundation, visit pbaf.org. or call 432-617-3213.
Hi, this is Jane, reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, January 5th, in the Health and Wellness section. Ask the pediatrician, what are some New Year's resolutions I can set with my kids? This article is by Dr. Lanre Falusi. Question from a parent. I would like to set some reasonable, healthy resolutions for the new year with my kids. What are some good ones to try? Answer. The start of a new year is a great time to help your children focus on forming good habits. Making New Year's resolutions can be a fun way to do this. As a pediatrician and mom of three kids, I know how important it is to set healthy boundaries and goals with kids and to be realistic about those. Kids can have fun keeping track on sticker charts or getting praise or rewards as they reach these goals, depending on their age. I encourage you to sit down with your kids and pick a few goals they want to set as their New Year's resolutions. If it's too overwhelming to think of them as resolutions, then just talk about them as goals and make it fun. Involving kids in the decision process and making these goals fun for the whole family can help turn these resolutions into long-lasting habits. Here are some ideas that you can suggest to your child depending on their age. For preschoolers, I will try to clean up my toys by putting them where they belong. I will let my parents help me brush my teeth twice a day. I will wash my hands after going to the bathroom and before eating. I will try new foods, especially different colors of vegetables. I will help clear the table when I am done eating. I will be friendly to all animals. I will ask the owners if I can pet their animals first. I will always hold a grown-up's hand when I cross the street. For ages 5 to 12 years old, I will drink water every day and healthy beverages like milk with meals. I will try to find a physical activity like playing tag, jumping rope, dancing or riding my bike, or a sport that I like to do and at least do it 3 times a week. I will always wear a helmet when riding a bike, scooter, or skateboard. I'll try to be friendly to kids who may have a hard time making friends by talking to them and inviting them to join activities. I will tell an adult about bullying that I see or hear about to find out what I can do to help schools safe for everyone. For ages 13 and older, I will try to eat 2 servings of fruit and 2 servings of vegetables every day. I will drink sodas or fruit drinks only at special events and on occasions. I will do my best to take care of my body through fun physical activity and eating the right types of food. I will try to choose educational, high-quality, nonviolent TV shows and video games that I enjoy. I will spend only 1 to 2 hours each day on these activities. I promise to respect our household rules for video games and internet use. I will try to get 8 to 10 hours of sleep each night. I will help out in my community. I will give some of my time to help others, working with community groups or others that help people in need. Dr. Faluzzi is a pediatrician in Washington, D.C. For more information about healthy children, go to healthychildren.org, the site for parents. Hi, this is Jane reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, health and wellness section, on Wednesday, January the 12th. Salcedo named Midland Memorial's latest recipient of the DAISY Award. Honoree nominated for taking initiative in post-anesthesia unit. Sarah Salcedo in Midland Memorial Hospital's post-anesthesia care unit, or PACU, is the latest DAISY Award honoree. The DAISY Award is an international nursing recognition program created to honor nurses who provide extraordinary, compassionate care. Midland Memorial is one of more than 4,900 healthcare facilities and schools of nursing worldwide that recognizes their nurses with this prestigious award. Anyone in the facility can nominate a nurse, be it a patient, visitor, another nurse, physician, or any other staff member, anyone who experiences or observes extraordinary compassionate care being provided by a nurse. Sarah was nominated by her manager for consistently going above and beyond to help her fellow PACU nurses and patients. For instance, during the last COVID surge, Sarah took the initiative to care for a COVID patient in PACU until they were ready to be discharged after surgery. Sarah cared for the patient instead of sending them to an inpatient unit, making more work for those nurses and staff. This also allowed another patient to take that inpatient room. Additionally, an anesthesiologist recognized Sarah for staying past the end of her shift to help with blood products to save a patient's life. The anesthesiologist said he is truly grateful. Sarah constantly does things without expecting anything in return, said Sarah's manager. She does the right thing for the patient every time, and that is enough reward for her. It is because of Sarah's compassionate and caring efforts that her patients experience a level of care that exemplifies the impact that nurses have in creating an environment where patients and families feel at home, Congratulations, Sarah Salcido. Have you recently had an extraordinary experience with a nurse at Midland Memorial Hospital? Please submit a DAISY Award nomination at the following link. https://www.midlandhealth.org/main/daisy-award-nomination.form.
This article is entitled "Texas Dems Hit Campaign Trails Despite COVID" by Patrick Svitek, the Texas Tribune. In the 2020 election cycle, many campaigns in Texas went fully virtual as the coronavirus pandemic, then a new and uncertain threat, bore down on the state. They held virtual rallies, phone banks, and fundraisers, trading in clipboards and walking shoes for webcams and microphones. As the weeks went on, though, Republicans resumed in-person campaigning and managed to stave off a massive Democratic offensive in November. Democrats later admitted that their decision to suspend door-knocking and other in-person activities hurt them. Now, nearly 2 years later, and with a new COVID-19 variant surging across the state, Democrats appear set on avoiding the same mistake. Few, if any, Democratic campaigns have gone fully virtual, and many are pressing forward with in-person campaigning while taking some precautions. Like everyone else across the globe, we are keeping a close eye on the COVID-19 Omicron variant and assessing the risks associated with this surge, Texas Democratic Party spokesman Angelica Luna Kaufman said in a statement. However, there is a lot at stake this midterm election, and in-person campaigning will be a critical component to engaging voters and winning these races. She emphasized the country is, quote, not in the same situation as we were in 2020, unquote. Vaccines are widely available, and people are well practiced in how to stay safe in public. Still, the Omicron variant looms large, and the campaign trail has not been immune to it. Some forums are still being held virtually, and candidates, staffers, and volunteers are having to deal with the logistical challenges that come when one of them tests positive amid the fast-spreading variant. Democrats' most likely celebrated candidate this cycle, gubernatorial contender Beto O'Rourke, has been regularly campaigning in person since launching his bid in November. He has been holding larger events outside, and his campaign asks attendees to wear masks and encourages them to be vaccinated. The campaign has made rapid testing available to attendees at some events. Speaking with Texans one-on-one is at the heart of our campaign, O'Rourke's campaign manager Nick Rathod said in a statement. After holding 70 events in 30 cities during the first weeks of our campaign, we remain committed to meeting Texans where they are and will continue to closely follow public health guidelines. O'Rourke was among the Democrats who lamented the party's refusal to campaign in person ahead of the 2020 election. He had been deeply involved in the fight for the Texas House majority through his Powered by People group, which shifted virtually all its activities online because of the pandemic. Writing to supporters after Republicans swept Texas in the election, O'Rourke said one of the lessons was nothing beats talking to voters eyeball to eyeball, and that there is a safe way to do this, even in a pandemic. A state Democratic Party autopsy that came out months later also cited the lack of in-person campaigning as a top factor, saying it hurt our ground game. Kendall Scudder, a Democratic state House candidate who had called for reform at the state party after the disappointing 2020 election, said COVID-19 was a real problem for Democrats to navigate back then. But we started using it as an excuse to not have to campaign, and we are not going to do that again. This article is entitled, Exxon Posts $23 Billion Profit Last Year. highest since 2014. By Paul Takahashi, staff writer. A year ago, ExxonMobil confronted its toughest challenge in its 140-year history. The nation's largest oil company suffered four consecutive quarters of losses in its upstream business, three straight quarters of losses in its refining business, and faced a public threat to the company's leadership from climate-minded activist investors. A year later, however, Exxon is celebrating its best year since 2014, raking in $23 billion in 2021 as oil demand and prices recovered from the pandemic-driven crash. Its new board, which includes three activist investor members, is preparing Exxon for a low-carbon future, setting it on a path toward net-zero carbon emissions from its operations by 2050. Our effective pandemic response, focused investments during the down cycle, and structural cost savings positioned us to realize the full benefits of the market recovery in 2021, CEO Darren Woods said. We've made great progress in 2021, and our forward plans position us to lead in cash flow and earnings growth, operating performance, and the energy transition. It appears the worst of the pandemic is in Big Oil's rearview mirror. However, Exxon's blockbuster earnings in 2021 came at a great cost to the Texas oil giant, which has slashed $5 billion from its business since 2019 and laid off 15% of its global workforce to weather the pandemic downturn. Woods, on Tuesday, said he expects cost-cutting measures and mass layoffs won't be the primary driver for Exxon's financial performance going forward, as the company reaps the benefits of operational efficiencies and recovering oil demand. Exxon, which plans to move its headquarters to Houston next year, on Tuesday reported a remarkable turnaround with 2021 profit and revenue surpassing pre-pandemic levels. The company's 2021 profit compares with a loss of $22.4 billion in 2020 and a profit of $14.3 billion in 2019. Annual revenue last year soared to $285.6 billion compared with $181.5 billion in 2020 and $264.9 billion in 2019. Exxon has reported four consecutive profitable quarters, reporting earnings of $8.9 billion in the 3 months ended December 31st, compared with a loss of $20.1 billion during the same period a year earlier. Fourth quarter revenue jumped by nearly 83% to $85 billion from $46.5 billion a year earlier. The rollout of coronavirus vaccines last year lifted restrictions on business and travel, raising demand for crude and petroleum products such as gasoline and jet fuel. West Texas Intermediate, the U.S. crude benchmark, settled Tuesday in New York at $88.20, up 5 cents from Monday and up from less than $50 a barrel a year ago. However, even as crude prices have recovered to 7-year highs, analysts do not expect publicly traded oil majors such as Exxon to go on a hiring spree as they maintain fiscal discipline to attract Wall Street investment back to the energy sector after years of poor performance. Most public energy producers have been hesitant to commit more capital given the price volatility of recent years, the pressure from shareholders to increase returns, and policy uncertainty, particularly related to the environment, said Peter McNally, global energy leader at New York market research firm Third Bridge. Exxon turned around its business by cutting $1.9 billion from its operations and divesting more than $3 billion of its non-core assets last year. The company also held capital spending on new projects to $16.6 billion last year, less than half the pre-pandemic spending level of $33 billion. Cost savings lowered the crude price at which Exxon can make money to $41 a barrel. the company expects further operational efficiencies will lower its so-called break-even oil price to $35 a barrel by 2027. Instead of drilling new wells, Exxon focused on paying down debt and returning more cash to shareholders. Exxon last year paid down $20 billion in debt, lowering its debt to pre-pandemic levels, while also returning $15 billion to shareholders through dividends. The company plans to buy back up to $10 billion of stock from shareholders over the next year to 2 years. Even as Exxon and other oil majors preach restraint, the company said plans to increase its capital spending on new projects by as much as 44% to $24 billion this year, although still well below pre-pandemic levels. It is also considering selective mergers and acquisitions opportunities. "We do have an ongoing active M&A group," Wood said. "We look for things where we can bring it into our portfolio and add unique value. It's got to be something where we feel like there's a synergy or a fit with what we're currently doing to deliver that value."
Hope seen once the Omicron wave increases global immunity. World health officials are offering hope that the ebbing of the Omicron wave could give way to a new, more manageable phase of the COVID-19 pandemic, even as they warn of difficult weeks ahead and the possibility of another, more dangerous variant arising. In the U.S., cases have crested and are dropping rapidly, following a pattern seen in Britain and South Africa, with researchers projecting a period of low spread in many countries by the end of March. Though U.S. deaths, now at 2,000 each day, are still rising, new hospital admissions have started to fall and a drop in deaths is expected to follow. The encouraging trends after 2 years of coronavirus misery have brought a noticeably hopeful tone from health experts. Rosy predictions have crumbled before, but this time they are backed by what could be called Omicron's silver lining. The highly contagious variant will leave behind extremely high levels of immunity. On Sunday, Dr. Anthony Fauci talked on ABC This Week about a best-case scenario where COVID-19 would fall to manageable levels, so the United States could get back to a degree of normality. And on Monday, the World Health Organization issued a statement anticipating an end to the emergency phase of the pandemic this year and saying that the Omicron variant offers plausible hope for stabilization and normalization. Both Fauci and the WHO's Europe Regional Director, Dr. Hans Kluge, cautioned that the new variants are likely to emerge, but with vaccination, new drug therapies, and during surges, testing and masks, the world could reach a less disruptive level of disease in which the virus is, as Fauci put it, essentially integrated into the general respiratory infections that we have learned to live with. In the U.S., new cases are averaging a still extraordinarily high 680,000 a day, down from an all-time peak of over 800,000 a little more than a week ago. The places in the U.S. where Omicron struck first are seeing the sharpest declines. New cases in the Northeast are nosediving, while other states, Arizona, Texas, Oregon, Kansas, and North Dakota among them, are still waiting for relief. Falling too are new U.S. hospital admissions of patients with confirmed COVID-19. They are averaging nearly 20,000 per day, down about 7% from the previous week, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Those numbers include patients who went to the hospital for other reasons and tested positive. But even after accounting for those incidental infections, the trend is hopeful. One influential model projects that nearly all nations will be past the Omicron wave by mid-March, including China and other countries with zero COVID policies. The wave will leave behind high levels of immunity, both from infection and vaccination. that could lead to low levels of transmission for many weeks or months. What do we end up with at the end of this? Said Dr. Christopher Murray of the University of Washington, who developed the closely watched Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation Model, we end up with the highest level of global immunity that we've seen in the pandemic. The model estimates that 57% of the world's population already has been infected with the virus at least once. Another research group, which combines several models and shares the projections with the White House, predicts a strong decline in U.S. infections by April, unless a new variant emerges that can sidestep the growing level of immunity. It would be dangerous to forget that possibility, as it has caught us before, said Catriona Shea of Pennsylvania State University, a member of the team that pulls together the models.
The technology behind the TVs. Question. I've been looking at new TVs and am thoroughly confused. What are the main pros and cons of the various types? Crystal UHD, NanoCell, OLED, QLED, and new QLED. Joseph B., Fort Walton Beach, Florida. Answer. I'm not a bit surprised at your confusion, Joseph. I haven't seen so many acronyms in one place since I retired from the Air Force in 2002. As you probably know, each of these describes a type of technology used to build the TV screen. Before we get into specifics, as usual, I want to provide some background for those not as familiar with TV lingo as you seem to be. After that, I'll answer your question as best I can. The first thing I'd like to do is separate some of your terminology. The name UHD, with or without the word crystal attached, stands for ultra high definition, and that generally refers to any display that's capable of at least 4K resolution or higher. Whoops. So what's a 4K? For that matter, what does resolution mean? It's all about the number of dots that makes up a TV's picture. These dots are called picture elements, or pixels, and all devices with display screens have them, whether a phone, a pad, a computer monitor, or a big screen TV. The more pixels the device has, the higher its resolution. Screen resolution has increased as technology has advanced, and it's measured by the number of pixels a screen has in the horizontal direction. The standard definition of older TVs displayed a puny width of only 640 pixels. Then along came high definition, or HD, and the width increased to 1280 or 1920, depending on which style of HD you were talking about. More recently came 4K, or, as previously mentioned, UHD, with, you guessed it, around 4,000 horizontal pixels. Some people claim that at 4K resolution, the human eye can no longer distinguish individual pixels on the screen. That's debatable, but it hasn't stopped the forward march of technology into screens that can do 8K. 16K and even 32K sets exist or are in various stages of development. You're unlikely to see those last couple in your local big box stores, as the price for them would easily be in the multiple tens of thousands of dollars. Then again, that's where 4K sets were just a few short years ago. Moving beyond raw resolution numbers, the LED portion of the acronyms you mentioned stands for light emitting diode. The screens in these sets consist of a matrix of one of a specific type of LED, each of which has its own unique characteristics. OLED stands for organic light emitting diode, and it actually uses a film of organic compound that emits light in response to electric current. OLEDs do not require a backlight to make the image visible. One of the benefits of an OLED is that when it is not emitting light, there is nothing at all visible, which provides very dark blacks beyond what other technologies can achieve. QLED, or quantum dot display, is a type of LCD, or liquid crystal display. It uses nanocrystals that produce pure red, green, and blue light. The so-called quantum dot particles convert the light from an LED backlight into the basic RGB colors that comprise a color picture. QLEDs are known for improved brightness and extremely vivid and precise colors. So, to summarize, and offer some of those pros and cons you asked for, UHD is a resolution, not a display type. OLED is a pure LED technology. It doesn't require a separate backlight, so generally the thinnest TVs are OLED. They are also known for an amazing reproduction range, from true black to vivid colors. QLED is an advanced type of LCD screen technology that has smaller cells than older LCD technologies. It requires a backlight behind the color layer to make the image visible. So let me close this discussion with some less geeky words, but words which you can probably use even more than everything else presented in this article. There is far more that goes into the selection of a TV than the technology that produces the picture. The vast majority of people can't see the difference between HD and UHD, and the differences and benefits that different technologies provide often require laboratory equipment to measure. One thing that I haven't mentioned at all is something that is often number one on everyone's priority list: price. There is an amazing array of TVs available for purchase. Visit your local store and engage with someone who knows what they're talking about. If they can't explain the difference between OLED and QLED, ask to talk to someone else. Take a good hard look at the display models, then read some reviews online before you make a purchase. To view additional content, comment on articles, or submit a question of your own, visit my website at itsgeektome.co, not .com. Jeff Werner is a software engineer and has been writing this column since 2007. You can find his past articles at itsgeektome.co.
MC students accepted into medical school. Midland. Four Midland College students are now one step closer to medical school. Michael Mangan, Jordan Ricks, Shaquela Sharapayo, and Marisol Tarin have all been accepted to Texas College of Osteopathic Medicine, TCOM, and will enter medical school in summer 2023. The students will graduate this coming May from Midland College, MC, with an Associate of Science degree through MC's Primary Care Pathway Program. This coming August, they will enter into the University of North Texas, UNT, and spend 1 year there taking upper-level science courses before entering TCOM. What all this means is that before obtaining their associate degrees, the four students have been accepted to medical school without having to take the rigorous and expensive MCAT medical school entrance exam. In just 5 years, they will enter a medical residency program, an accomplishment that normally takes 8 years at a minimum. MC Associate Professor of Biology Joseph Schenkman serves as coordinator of the Primary Care Pathway Program. He explained that the purpose of the program is to increase the number of physicians practicing primary care in the Midland area and in the state of Texas. The program contains the following components: 1. An enhanced 3-year pre-med curriculum that includes 2 years at MC and 1 year at UNT. 2. Healthcare enrichment activities that include mentoring and physician shadowing. And 3. Summer enrichment experience. Since 2016, when the program began, 24 graduates have been accepted into TCOM. To be eligible for MC's Primary Care Pathways program, high school graduates must have competitive college entrance exam scores and be U.S. citizens or permanent residents with Texas residency. Dual credit coursework may be accepted at the discretion of the program committee. Shinkman said the students who successfully complete all of their requirements in the prescribed time frame, while maintaining at least a 3.5 GPA, may be granted an interview that can lead to an offer of early acceptance admission to TCOM. Additionally, by attaining only A's and B's while maintaining the 3.5 GPA, the submission of an MCAT score will be waived. Mangan, Ricks, Sharapeo, and Tareen are four of those students. Shinkman further explained that in addition to partnering with UNT and TCOM, the program's success can also be attributed to a third partner, Midland Memorial Hospital. Because of the relentless efforts of our three partners, the Midland community, and of course, Midland College faculty, staff, and administration, these students have continued to gain the foundation necessary to continue their success beyond Midland and Midland College, Shinkman said. Midland College has provided these students the tools and support for their success, but it is their drive and motivation toward medicine that makes them truly successful.
Academy to hold public hearing. Property owners, parents, and others who serve in a guardian relationship to students attending the campuses of Richard Milburn Academy are invited to attend a public hearing regarding the academic performance of the district. Richard Milburn Academy will host the public hearing at 10 a.m. Friday by video conference. The hearing is based on the Texas Academic Performance Report for the 2021 school year. A report will be distributed and public participation in the discussion is invited. Those interested also may visit Richard Milburn Academy website at rmaschools.org under required resource for additional information regarding this report. Lubbock Artists Ceramics now on display at MC by J.C. Lewis. Ceramic pieces by Lubbock-based artist James C. Watkins are now on view until February 11th at Allison Fine Arts Building, McCormick Gallery, at Midland College. Watkins was born in Louisville, Kentucky in 1951. He was raised on a farm in Athens, Alabama. He has worked with clay for 40 years in Lubbock. Watkins is known for large-scale, double-walled ceramic vessels and laser-cut porcelain substrate tiles. There will be a special presentation by Watkins in room 138 of the Allison Fine Arts Building from 6 to 8:45 p.m. on February 2nd. The public is also invited to a reception to view the works from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. the same day. Watkins will be hosting free demonstrations from 10 a.m. to noon, 1 to 3:45 and 6 to 8:45 on February 1st and at 10 a.m. to noon on then 1 to 3:45 on February 2nd. The McCormick Gallery is open 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Thursday and 8 to 5 on Friday. Miss Texas visits MISD campuses. 2021 Miss Texas Mallory Fuller visited Pease Communications, Young Women's Leadership Academy, and Franks Elementary last week as part of her tour of West Texas. Fuller spoke with students to raise awareness about the importance of mental health. She is the author of children's book Henry's Happy Heart, which focuses on mental health in a kid-friendly way. Fuller's visit to MISD was made possible by the Literacy Coalition of the Permian Basin, a nonprofit that raises awareness of low literacy and illiteracy issues in the region, as well as providing access to family and adult literacy programming. Rusk sixth graders learn about banking on field trip. Rusk Elementary students in Avery Pullen's sixth grade class visited Community National Bank in December to learn about all aspects of the banking industry. Pullen's students learned about money by participating in the stock market game, which teaches students about investing by using $100,000 in imaginary funds to invest in simulated training. At CMB, kids learned how to write and deposit checks and found counterfeit bills. They visited the vault and sat in the boardroom to hear a mock loan presentation. We were treated like professionals the entire day, and I can't get over how much students learned from this experience, Pullum said. I can't thank CMB enough for creating even more interest in the world of banking and finance.
UTPB looks to offer environmental science major. For the last several years, University of Texas Permian Basin has offered environmental science as a minor, but if all goes well, the major could be revived next fall. Biology lecturer Irene Perry said the major was in place when she and her family arrived in Odessa in the late 1990s. The professor that was in charge of it left, and it kind of withered on the vine, Perry said. When Associate Professor of Chemistry Milka Montez, who is also the department chair, came on board in 2011, the environmental science minor was still in place. All the science degrees that offer the environmental science minor continued to offer it, but not a lot of people did it. And I kind of picked it up, and so since 2011, we continued offering the minor for chemistry and biology majors and some geology, Montez said. Last year, they submitted a request to revive the environmental science major. They had to go through the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board and approval from the provost, Montez said. If all goes well, the major could be offered in fall 2021. We're trying to bring back the major itself, Montez said. The minor is still available. All this time, we've been offering all the courses necessary. We only needed to create maybe one course to complete the major. The courses are housed in biology, chemistry, and geology. Biology lecturer Irene Perry is going to teach the basic courses, and those will be straight environmental science. All aspects, Montes said. We, of course, focus on water, and then we spend time on energy as well, Perry said. And that's been a lot of fun because the students are upper-level students, and they come from biology, chemistry, and geology. I'm familiar with the biology students and their background, but the chemistry and the other disciplines, it's interesting to see what they bring to the class. Monte said whatever students learn with a minor can be applied to jobs in the water industry and environmental and health and safety fields. Asked about environmental science going against the oil and gas industry, they said even though they are heavy on energy and oil and the production of oil, the companies still want to abide by regulations. Monte said it's important for the university to produce graduates that can work for environmental agencies, environmental chemistry, or can keep companies in compliance. The major will be interdisciplinary, involving hydrogeology, geochemistry, and water chemistry, environmental law, and other areas. She added that it involves not only the College of Arts and Sciences, but business and potentially engineering. We also have a component that has to do with the legal areas and the implications of environmental science. We have professors from information technology that are going to join us when we actually launch the program. Environmental law and people from business. We took all the classes that were offered and then put the puzzle together, Montes said. Perry noted that the courses existed for an environmental science major, but they were splintered. Putting them into one major shows the interest not only of the students, but in the faculty. Ector County ISD celebrates School Board Recognition Month. January is School Board Recognition Month, and Ector County ISD is honored to celebrate its trustees for their dedication and commitment to the ECISD's students and staff. This celebration is even more special this year, knowing our board is the Region 18 Outstanding School Board, ECISD Superintendent Scott Murray said in a news release. School board members are unpaid. They are selfless. They spend long hours working to ensure all of our students have the opportunity to learn, grow, and pursue whatever passion they choose. School Board Recognition Month is a time for our entire community to tell them thank you for all they do. Serving as a link between the community and classroom, school board members are elected to establish the policies that provide the framework for public schools. The ECISD board is responsible for an annual budget of $350 million, more than 32,000 students, 4,200 employees, and 43 campuses. School boards provide the local governance and oversight that makes it possible for school districts to serve students, including establishing a strategic plan, adopting policies, approving a budget, and selecting and evaluating a superintendent. The ECISD Board of Trustees has provided steady guidance through an historically difficult period of time. Through the twists and turns of the COVID-19 pandemic, the school board kept its focus on health, safety, and student achievement through a variety of strategic plan initiatives. An expansion of pre-kindergarten services to include 3-year-old children, the rollout of a district-wide K-12 computer science curriculum, high-impact tutoring that is supporting some 6,000 ECISD students as they recover from COVID learning loss, and the continued advancement of work to provide reliable, affordable, broadband internet service are just a few examples of ECISD's commitment to its students. The trustees have also pushed for more opportunities for teachers, leading to the implementation of opportunity culture, teacher initiative allotment, and a multi-year partnership, giving district teachers the chance to pursue National Board for Professional Teaching Standards certification. This month, trustees will receive an update from the local bond committee to address the long-range facilities plan. At the board meeting on January 17th, district leaders will recognize School Board Recognition Month with special items thanking the trustees for their service. Tammy Hawkins, Board President, Delma Abalos, Board Vice President, Steve Brown, Board Secretary, Carol Gregg, Donna Smith, Nelson Minyard, and Chris Stanley.
Inflamed esophagus. Dear Dr. Roach, recently I read an article that said we are wasting our money buying vitamins because they don't really help us stay healthy. What are your thoughts about that? Anon. Answer. For most people with a healthy diet, vitamins are probably useless. Many very good studies have examined whether vitamins help prevent disease, but none have been convincingly done so. Whether vitamins can help in people with a poor diet remains debated. Personally, I'd spend the money you would have spent on vitamins on more fruits and vegetables. This time of year, frozen is a cheap and healthy option. Dr. Roach regrets that he is unable to answer individual letters, but will incorporate them in the column whenever possible. Readers may email questions to yourgoodhealth@med.cornell.edu. To your good health, Dr. Keith Roach.
Teen feels overwhelmed as challenges pile up. Dear Abby, I'm a teen girl having some trouble right now. I was in an abusive family. Most of my life I was bullied because I separated from them because they were doing drugs. I have serious depression, and my foster family hasn't noticed. I have given them plenty of signs. I have trouble talking about my feelings, but they ignore them. I had a best friend who helped me through the pain, but she started showing her true colors and turned out to be a jerk. I'm also having trouble finding someone who will love me because I want to be in love. Everyone treats me like a little kid, even though I'm the oldest. Sorry for dumping all my problems on you, but I really need help. It's not fun crying myself to sleep every night. Signed, Depressed Girl in Iowa. Dear Depressed Girl, I'm sure it's not fun. You have had some hurdles to climb, but you are in your teens and not a little kid. You should not be keeping your sadness bottled up inside. That's why it's important for you to find a trusted adult you can talk with about your feelings. If you're in school, a counselor or teacher you trust may be able to provide the support and understanding you're looking for. While most people want to find someone to love who will love them back, I think you would be wise to put that on the back burner until you are stronger emotionally. If you can do that, you'll make better choices in the future. Dear Abby, I committed a sin with my husband's brother many years ago that I've regretted ever since. I've confessed to God, but I need to tell someone. I know you cannot solve my mistake. My husband was not very affectionate, but we went on to have a family and many good years together. I guess I don't feel I deserved all those blessings. How can I get rid of this feeling of guilt for what I did? Signed, Evil Lady in the South. Dear Lady, because you won't allow me to absolve you from the one sin you committed many years ago, please discuss it with a religious advisor. If you're afraid to do that with your own priest, pastor, rabbi, etc., make an appointment to talk with one in a different community. While you may be racked with guilt, believe me, nothing you confess is something they haven't heard before. I hope it helps you to stop flogging yourself. Dear Abby, please clear this up for me. My mother recently passed away. My family and I miss her every day. Her funeral was prepaid, so there were no additional expenses for my family. In the funeral notice, we ask that people give memorials of money to the charity listed, or a charity of the donor's choice. My co-workers collected money and gave it to me. Was the money intended to be a charitable donation from them in my mother's honor, or was it meant for me personally? I'm confused. Signed, Confused in Minnesota. Dear Confused, please accept my sympathy for the loss of your mother. Because your co-workers didn't specify otherwise, assume they followed the guidelines in the obituary and the money is for the charity. Thank them for their generosity and leave it at that.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.